Hello, and welcome to CKUT's Off the Hour with the News Collective. My name is Nelson Graves, and today we've got a really packed show. We're going to be talking about the SSMU's court win. Then we're going to talk about some CIJA lobbies, and we're talking about candidates who received money from this Israeli lobby group. And then finally, we'll just be doing a post-election breakdown, talking about who are the winners, who are the losers, and everything in between. Quickly, before we get started, I just wanted to plug our funding drum event that's happening at our normal show time from 5 to 6 next week at Casa del Popolo. We'll be doing a live show. So if you're interested in knowing what it's like to be on the other side of the mic, feel free to drop by. We'll be on there just kind of like shooting the breeze about all sorts of different stuff, different current events. But yeah, so definitely stop by. But
go ahead. Quickly on that, actually, it's going to be, there's like a series of shows that are happening live from Casa, so you don't want to miss the hour after that, I think is 6 to 7.
Well, yes, it'll be
eight. No, right?
So 6 to 7, which will be our reporter here at CKUT's segment, Jules. It's called Talk Shit O'Clock.
It's gonna be fire.
It's gonna be hilarious. And then finally, we have something from the Harbinger Showcase afterwards. They'll be doing a live event as well. So definitely stop by from anytime from 5 to 8. But I definitely, if you have to pick one, come to ours.
That's at Casa del Popolo, 4873 Saint Laurent, as part of the funding drive. Again, the funding drive is CKUT's kind of week-long funding event where we're just asking the community to pitch in and support community radio. CKUT does such wonderful things. I don't know.
Yeah, everything.
They do everything. So be sure to kind of take part. There's so many fun events that are happening, but yeah.
Yeah, and if you want to donate, it's ckut.ca/donate. And you can get a little t-shirt or a magnet or whatever with your donation. Yeah. But I'm going to pass this over to Kaya, and we're going to chat a bit about the SSMU court win. So thank you, Kaya.
Yeah, so basically our first section is going to be about the injunction that was placed on SSMU. So we're going to have a little outline first, and then I'm going to give you some audio from a press conference that we had about last week. So first up, on April 10th, McGill administration petitioned the Quebec Superior Court for a 10-day anti-protest injunction, and that was in an effort to prevent any demonstrations near like campus, near buildings, on paths, streets, walkways. Basically, they're just trying to block any mobilization from happening on campus. But a week later, on April 17th, the Quebec Court of Appeals unanimously struck down an injunction blocking the ratification of the policy against genocide in Palestine. So this policy actually was originally passed in November of 2023, and it had the highest referendum turnout in SSMU history. And that's really insane when you think about how SSMU was founded in 1908. So 117 years ago, and this is the highest record. So I think it really goes to show how passionate the student body is about this. So the policy itself begins by outlining the really, really dire circumstances faced by Palestinians before moving on to discuss the specific response that McGill has had to student activism in the past two years. So the quote, instead of condemning this escalating genocide, the McGill administration has publicly threatened students who voice their solidarity with the Palestinian people. The policy continues to put forth the following demands: that the administration publicly condemn the genocidal bombing campaigns and siege against the people of Gaza, cut ties with any corporations, institutions, or individuals complicit in genocide, settler colonialism, apartheid, or ethnic cleansing against Palestinians, and finally, that the SSMU make a public statement condemning the ongoing genocide against Palestinians of Gaza. With the court's ruling that preventing the policy's ratification violates students' freedom of expression and democratic rights, Hugo Victor Solomon of the SSMU fulfilled the final demand with the following statement.
SSMU is ready to do what the injunction tried to prevent and McGill tried to convince us out of, to enact the full mandates of the policy against genocide in Palestine. And as such, on behalf of the 25,000 members of the SSMU and pursuant to Section 2.4 of the policy, I unequivocally condemn the ongoing genocide, war crimes, and human rights violations endured by the steadfast people of Chazan. We affirm once and for all that the Student Society of McGill University stands in unambiguous solidarity with our Palestinian and Arab peers.
So that was Hugo Victor Solomon, VP External of SSMU, finally taking a stand with the SSMU, officially saying that the SSMU stands with Palestine. The following audio that I have for you is from a press conference jointly hosted by the SSMU and the Concordia Student Union on April 25th, in which the two student unions discuss the implications of this court win on the broader fight for student democracy, as well as, you know, more abstract implications on the protection of political expression on campus. So first up is Hugo Victor Solomon again.
The recent injunction granted to McGill toward SPHR and the SMU regarding protests on campus?
Yeah, so interestingly, I was actually in court this morning because McGill has requested both to renew the 10-day injunction and also has said that they're seeking potentially a safeguard order. The outcome of that hearing, to my understanding, has not been rendered yet, but with respect to the first hearing, McGill submitted absolutely no evidence of any upcoming mobilizations of any kind. They did not have proof from, you know, social media posts. They did not have proof from flyers on campus. And yet still they claim that because there might be finals happening, they have a fear that, you know, something might happen, even though, of course, in the past we know that there have been no disruptions to actual exams by any kind of ongoing mobilization. What's really troubling to me, though, is that in supplementary affidavits submitted on behalf of the university, Provost Angela Campbell provided evidence from this fake Instagram account called Escalate McGill, which was actually impersonating me, and claimed that I was going to be leading a second round of strikes starting on April 14th, when in fact I was giving my mother a tour of campus on that very day. So I know it's very absurd to even say out loud, but the point is, even if there is this Instagram account which is claiming that things are happening, they're not. So they don't really have any clear evidence of to justify urgency. And if anything, they're just looking for more kind of pieces of evidence from the court to justify repression on the ISGs, the independent student groups that are affiliated with the SSMU in McGill, and to use that and take advantage of the fact that people don't have legal literacy to say, see, mobilization is bad. So I think it's to impose a chilling effect. We oppose it completely, and that's why we intervened and have submitted multiple affidavits to oppose it.
Yeah. I have a question for you.
Sure.
So regarding the negotiations that communications have stated will end around June, obviously there's an imbalance of experience between McGill administration and SMU executives when it comes to negotiating SMU's position.
Right.
What can you say to students that are afraid that SSMU will fold to administration's pressure and will no longer be representative of the student body's wishes?
I think that's a really important question, first of all, because in the power imbalance that you mentioned is also really key, because McGill has taken advantage of that in multiple situations, for example, to force the SSMU to remove club status from SPHR or other activities, and sort of to use these legal maneuvers in order to extract political concessions. That goes back all the way to 2011. You can actually see a blog post on the University Affairs website of the SSMU for a full timeline of those kinds of events, which is all to say that these concerns are valid, and I think that was exactly why the board of directors created a new negotiations committee that I am helping to chair. And so this is composed of people from the board of directors, the people who are going to be creating these mandates for the negotiators, people from legislative council, people from the external affairs team, and members of the public, members of the SMU community at large. So there's going to be a broad array of representation there. We also have the privilege of working with Meth Glazer, who is our internal counsel, who is a full professional licensed lawyer, who will be one of the negotiators. So to address the concerns about like imbalance, we have someone who is a very experienced lawyer, someone who actually worked for McGill previously, and we've been working very closely. And if people have any feedback, they're more than welcome to contact the negotiations committee through the form that was sent in the campus-wide SMU email. There's a form there to provide your feedback. Or to contact me at external at SSMU.ca.
Thank you.
Yeah, sorry.
One more, yeah. Is there an update on the student who was hospitalized during the strike 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, I don't have consent from that individual student to kind of share more personal details, but I can say that they are out. I can say that they're out of the hospital and they are doing better. But I think even though we highlighted this one incident in the statement, that is not the only instance of the kind of repression that we saw over the course of the 3-day strike and after. I know McGill has expressed concerns about classes being disrupted, but that is no excuse for brutalizing students. In fact, there is no excuse for brutalizing students, and I think more details will be definitely emerging as people come forward. Well, I think just one more point to kind of talk a little bit about what Dana was describing at the end. This is a bit of a weaponization of space, of who has access to space, who can be on the university, who has the right to protest, and what does that protest look like? And for example, the University Center across the street from us right now, that is the biggest piece, that is the biggest chip in the negotiating table right now. And the same thing is occurring right now at CSU, as Dana was talking about, taking away access to room bookings on the university campus because they oppose the democratic decision of the student body. And in both cases, it is unacceptable, and we will continue to take the steps that we need to preserve student autonomy. Anything else you'd like to share, Dana?
That's it from me.
Okay. If there's no other questions, thank you all so much for coming. Really, really appreciate it.
Sorry about that, guys. I made a mistake and played the clips in the wrong order. So that was the Q&A section that came at the end of the press conference. The following two clips are the speech from Hugo Richter-Solman and the CSU mobilization and external coordinator. So here are those clips.
Well beyond a single campus. Today, we celebrate a landmark victory for student democracy. On April 17th, 2025, the Quebec Court of Appeal unanimously overturned the injunction that had, for over a year, blocked the ratification of the democratically adopted policy against genocide in Palestine. The court ruled in favor of the SSMU on all grounds: appearance of right, irreparable harm, and the fundamental importance of protecting student political expression. As the court made clear, il ne revient pas aux tribunaux d'arbitrer des débats politiques internes à une association étudiante démocratique. It is not for the courts to arbitrate political debates internal to a democratic student association. And this is more than a legal win. It's a resounding affirmation that students have the right to speak, to organize, and to demand justice. Meanwhile, McGill University has pursued a sustained campaign of repression, canceling meetings with student leaders, submitting anonymous and unverified claims in court targeting student executives, and relying on far-right Islamophobic media sources like Sky News Australia to build its case against student organizing. And even when the SSMU held a peaceful, democratic, and procedurally sound General Assembly on March 27th, the university allowed riot police, mounted unit, and drones around campus, and then falsely claimed after the fact that procedures hadn't been followed. This is not just a debate about adherence to policy, it is about power. And at the heart of the legal challenge against the SSMU was a dangerous argument advanced by plaintiffs that the policy against genocide in Palestine was potentially anti-Semitic simply because it criticized Israeli state violence. In doing so, they echoed a broader and deeply troubling trend, one we see spreading across North America, where pro-Palestine speech is falsely equated with anti-Semitism to justify repression, firings, suspension, and disappearances. This includes Jewish students and faculty who dissent from official narratives. And yet, the Court of Appeals decisively rejected this logic. It found the lower court's conclusion, calling the policy potentially anti-Semitic, was legally unfounded and incompatible with students' rights to organize and take political positions. Criticizing a government, even one with complex identities, is not discrimination. And that is why the SSMU fought to pass a policy against anti-Semitism rooted in the Jerusalem Declaration and Nexus documents, frameworks that protect Jewish students without being weaponized to suppress Palestinian solidarity. In light of McGill's refusal to pursue non-legal good faith dialogue, despite having done so in the past, whether during the anti-apartheid movements of 1985 or the fossil fuel divestment campaigns of 2023, we echo the words of the McGill Tribune: McGill is creating the hostile environment it falsely accuses student activists of perpetuating. But today, we are no longer restrained by legal barriers or fear tactics. Today, the SSMU is ready to do what the injunction tried to prevent and McGill tried to convince us out of, to enact the full mandates of the policy against genocide in Palestine. And as such, on behalf of the 25,000 members of the SSMU and pursuant to Section 2.4 of the policy, I unequivocally condemn the ongoing genocide, war crimes, and human rights violations endured by the steadfast people of Gaza. We affirm once and for all that the Student Society of McGill University stands in unambiguous solidarity with our Palestinian and Arab peers. And let me be clear, we welcome dissent. We welcome debate at Legislative Council, General Assembly, and at all of our levels. Yet, unlike the administration, our political decisions are driven by democratic mandate. It could be anyone else delivering this message, because it was the students who chose to ratify this policy. And nearly 80% of 8,000 student voters supported that policy. That's not fringe. That's not, you know, exceptional. It's not controversial. That is the outcome of democracy. Attacking the structure itself is not just dangerous. It undermines the very values that a university should hold. So this victory belongs to every student, Jewish, Palestinian, Muslim, Arab, and allied, who stood firm in the face of repression, who refused to let silence be the price of their education. And let me be clear, we will continue to protect students, to protect democracy, and above all, to resist injustice, whether it be legal or administrative. Thank you all so much, and I stand for questions after the presentation.
Bonjour, good afternoon. My name is Dana Noor Ballantyne, and I am the Concordia Student Union's External and Mobilization Coordinator. I am here today not only as a Palestinian, but as the representative of a student body who for more than a year now have used every channel and tactic available to be heard by an institution who consistently chooses repression over dialogue. On April 17th, the Quebec Court of Appeals made abundantly clear what student organizers have known all along, that our right to protest and to speak out against our administrations must be protected. And subsequently, that our universities who cannot justify their actions through fair, open dialogue must consistently resort to bad faith intimidation tactics to suppress the student movement for Palestine. Tactics like increased security, physical violence against students, the weaponization of university policy, racist and Islamophobic public statements, and legal threats. For the past 18 months, Concordia students, like our peers at McGill and all across North America, have witnessed a disturbing pattern of targeted crackdowns against Palestinian and pro-Palestinian students on our campuses. Since the CSU's historic special general meeting on January 29th of this year, where students voted with a 94% majority in favor of the proposed BDS motion, our administration has weaponized policy, bureaucracy, and legal threats to punish students for exercising their democratic rights. Following that vote, Concordia suspended the Concordia Student Union's right to book spaces on campus based on ableist, anti-Arab, Islamophobic, and unsubstantiated accusations pending an unclear investigation process. This action was taken in violation of the university's own policies, without due process, without a formal complaint, and without giving student organizers any opportunity to respond. Since the notice of these arbitrary sanctions, the CSU has operated in good faith, attempting to receive any information on the nature and status of the investigation, but to no avail. By refusing to follow their own procedures and to engage in meaningful dialogue in any capacity, the administration left us absolutely no choice but to pursue legal action in the form of a judicial review. Ultimately, their weaponization of policy and law is nothing more than an attempt to punish and stall student organizing through lengthy and unfounded proceedings. But this is not an isolated incident. On December 17th, a Palestinian student was violently assaulted inside the Hall building after completing a final exam. Despite the students' and the union's direct requests, Concordia refused to issue any warning or notice to the campus community, claiming that the attack did not meet the, quote, evidentiary threshold to merit a response. Instead, they rushed to condemn a nonviolent democratic vote the very next month, calling it deeply troubling, without providing a single piece of evidence to back their claims. This is the same administration that spent over $30,000 hiring private security firms with ties to the Israeli military. It's the same administration whose security guards, CSPS, have shown up at peaceful demonstrations with zip-tie handcuffs and body cameras. Students have been tackled, suspended indefinitely, and in some cases handed over directly to the police for as little as handing out flyers and wheat-pasting posters. By continuously investing in over-surveillance rather than good faith discourse, our administrations are manifesting the very protests and strikes they claim to be responding to. Let me say this clearly. We cannot have academic freedom if we are not free to denounce an act of genocide. We cannot have student democracy if the price for participation is suspension, criminalization, and physical violence. And we certainly cannot celebrate our diversity while refusing to acknowledge entire communities. True diversity is not just about inclusion in name. It is about protecting the freedom to speak out, to take political stances, and to fight against injustice, no matter how uncomfortable or expensive this may be for those in power. The highest court in Quebec has clearly affirmed not just our right to speak out, but the broader principle that universities cannot be complicit in silencing dissent. Our fight is about more than Palestine. It is about the fundamental right of every student to freely express their political beliefs and to demand accountability for those in power. Thank you so much. Free Palestine.
So that was Dana Noor, the CSU External and Coordination Mobilization Coordinator. I think, just as a wrap-up of this section, I think it's important to emphasize how much of a win this is that McGill took SSMU, an accredited student union, to court, to a legal court, and, you know, we have had our right for free speech protected, and we've been, I don't know, it's just a good moment, it's time to, oh my gosh, sorry, let me...
No, it's a really good moment. It's really historic, and this is something that, you know, it doesn't just affect McGill, but also Concordia and other universities here in Quebec, and just reaffirms the rights of students to protest.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the fact that they've like been taking like legal actions against us, but this moment of like having the law on our side for once and protecting student mobilization.
No, it's wild. And the SSMU and also just McGill in general they've been in court like constantly. I mean, there's not just this, there's been other things filed for various different urgencies. But like, no, it's nice to have a win in all of this.
Okay, thank you so much, Kaya, for that wonderful coverage and for going out and covering the press conference and catching us up on that. We're going to take a little ad break, and we will be right back with some spicy election coverage. So please stick around for that.
CKUT's annual funding drive is back from May 2nd to 11th, and this year we're booming and blooming louder, weirder, and more beautiful than ever. From radio waves to dance floors, backyard barbecues, and live broadcasts, we're turning up across the city to celebrate the station that has been keeping Montreal fresh for decades. But powering independent radio isn't cheap. We're aiming to raise $55,000 to keep CKUT loud and proud. So if you love what you hear, help us grow. Donate now at ckut.ca/donate or call 514-907-9424. CKUT 90.3 FM, booming and blooming across Montreal since 1987.
Yeah. CKUT 90.3 FM presents Booming and Blooming, a funding drive kickoff party on Friday, May 2nd at Club 2061. That's Club 2061 at 2061 Rue Saint-Denis. Doors open at 10 p.m., featuring two floors with CKUT DJs, including THT Entertainment of Whose Vibe Is It Anyways, Everton Green and Mikey Don of Weekend Groove, 514 Online Mix of Underground Sounds, Ziploc's Blaster and Mystical Flex of Ill Groove Garden, with special guests DJ Red Dread and more. Admission, only $10. Doors open at 10 p.m. That's Boomin' and Bloomin', Friday, May 2nd at Club 2061.
The 41st edition of the Festival International de Musique Actuelle Victoriaville takes place from May 12th to 18th, with two major concerts on Saturday, May 17th. Mats Gustafsson's Fire Orchestra, which features 14 Canadian musicians from coast to coast, and Sleepy Time Guerrilla Museum. Also, experimental cinema by Oscar nominee Bill Morrison on May 16th. Box office information at fimav.qc.ca. That's fimav.qc.ca.
Okay, we are back. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. This is Off the Hour. This is the collectively run news show put on by yours truly, the News Collective. We are always live in the studio. And yeah, we have so many great volunteers who put together a great show every week. So yeah, for this segment, we kind of wanted to just talk about the election, but specifically what this post-election result means for progressives in Canada and means for Palestine as well. Because if you recall, if you're a dedicated listener and you don't miss a single Off the Hour, which I hope there are some of you who are out there, we did do a whole segment on Vote Palestine. And this is kind of, you know, a group that put together a Palestine platform and tried to get the candidates who were running to endorse it. And we'll hear a little bit more about the details of that platform. But anyway, so over the next little bit, we're going to we kind of just like looked at two separate things. So first was there's this wonderful article and research done by David Mastracci, who this was published in The Maple. And it kind of and he looked at which incumbents were lobbied by CEJA. And Julie's going to explain what CEJA is. So just kind of this like Jewish Israeli pro-Israel, I guess, lobby group in Canada. So we're kind of looking at the all the candidates who won in Montreal and how much they were lobbied, yeah, like just kind of what their affiliation with CEJA is. So that's one thing. And the second thing we're gonna look at is which Vote Palestine candidates got elected in Montreal. But Julie, do you want to give us a little intro for the first bit about what CEJA is and what we're going to be talking about?
Yeah, sure. So the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs is basically a Zionist lobby group in Canada. It attempts to, quote-unquote, fight for issues that matter to the Canadian Jewish community and strengthen the Canadian-Israel friendship. That's what's said in the CEJA website. However, this Canadian-Israel friendship played an important role in these 2025 federal elections through lobbying. Mm. So overall, like through the Maple article, we see that 58% of incumbents running in the election have been lobbied or taken on trips to Israel by CEJA. So taken together, CEJA spent almost $700,000 on trips for these MPs since 2007 and lobbied them 579 times since 2008.
Yeah, and then I mean just to hop in here, so Mastracci, like, just looking at his methodology, I'm just going to read off his article a little bit. What he did was he looked at the incumbents, he searched their names in, and an incumbent is the person who was previously elected before, who held that seat. And then he looked up their names in the registry of lobbyists. This is like a public thing. You can actually search it if you're ever interested to see like who is talking to the government, who's spending money at the government, how many times they're meeting. It's all public. It's a little clunky, but you can look it up. And so he kind of looked at, he searched up Sija. And I think that it's like the entries start in 2008. And then, yeah, he kind of just like looked up how many times they had met. So this is where he got his data from. And yeah, so like, interestingly enough, Sija has not taken MPs on trips to Israel since 2023, because I think there was the lobbyist code of conduct was updated. And it means that, you know, it basically just disallowed people from taking MPs, like paying for travel and whatnot. I think that kind of makes sense, just because, like, you know, if somebody's paying for like multi-$1,000 trip, what did the person say? The cost of for sponsored travel could reasonably be seen to create a sense of obligation on the part of that official or whatnot. Anyway, so they're not taking trips anymore, I guess, but. Yeah. Anyway, so we kind of looked at who Sija lobbied in Montreal. And again, this is like since 2008, but these are the incumbents, and these are, so there's, I think, how many? 1, 2, 3, 4 people here. So we have Anjou Dion, who's a liberal, who won in Dorval, Lachine, LaSalle. Dion has taken $9,500 trip to Israel. We have Anthony Housefather, who is a liberal who ran in Mount Royal. Anthony Housefather has met with Sija 73 times, which is the most on the entire list. We looked through the entire list, and that is by far the most times that an MP has met with Sija since, I think this is 2008, but this is like, it means that he's meeting with Sija multiple times.
It's not even close, right? Because like, there's been, I mean, the normal amount, like for most members of parliament, yeah, as we've seen, were like a couple of times.
Yeah, like, you know, maybe you get lobbied,
like 4 or 5, a couple of like tens, like in the teens, right? Yeah. 73 is...
73 is quite...
It's not even, it's a wide margin.
He's a huge Israel advocate.
He is.
He's always talking about it in parliament. Yeah. His riding is the only majority Jewish riding in Canada, so he's...
And there was actually, like, there was a challenge.
And he lost, too.
No, he won.
No, I'm pretty sure... Okay,
well... He won, but there was a very tight contest with Neil Oberman, I think, and it was a conservative guy. Anyway, so there was...
Okay, I was looking at the results yesterday as it was still coming
No,
up.
I remember, because I remember seeing that, and I was like, wow, like, Anthony Housefather might lose his seat. That's crazy.
Yeah. Well, Neil Oberman was also on the list of MPs that took trips to Israel, is he not? So
yeah, that's interesting. See, I didn't catch his name because he didn't win, but I believe that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could double check that.
Yeah, a lot of those conservative candidates were running on very pro-Israel positions in Montreal as well, like Ronan Reich as well. I saw a video by him where he was like, we're going to shut down the campus protests. And I was you're not even in, like, your riding isn't even campus.
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
I mean, the Conservative Federal Party in general has been, like, very, very aggressive in terms of, like, cracking down on, you know, their rhetoric was very enthusiastic about, like, cracking down on student protests, especially, like, with regards to Israel and Gaza. So I'm not super surprised that the Conservative Party MPs in this area are like relatively strict about that. But yeah, it's the Liberals are a bit more of a mixed bag, as we've seen.
Yeah. Interestingly, so okay, there's two more MPs, or yeah, I guess like yeah, MPs who won their seat in Montreal. And that is okay. Sorry, and this is Rachel Bendayen. So she is a liberal. She was running in Outremont. She met with Sija 20 times since 2008. There is Patricia Latanzio, also a liberal, running in Saint-Leonard, Saint-Michel, who also took a $17,000 trip to Israel. So there are 4 liberals who are kind of running in Montreal who have some pretty explicit ties to Sija. So I don't know. I just kind of wanted to like make that public, let people kind of know that those are the MPs that are running?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting information. I honestly think that a lot of voters don't even know that this information is out there in terms of like, lobbying information in general, and like who our MPs are associated with.
Yeah.
So it's good to have that kind of transparency.
Absolutely. And so the next part of this is the Vote Palestine contingent. Julie, if you want to kind of tell us a little bit about Vote Palestine, what that platform is.
Yeah, Vote Palestine is a collective nonpartisan campaign across Canada, which gathers several partisans for Palestine to push for rights and freedom during the Canadian federal elections. So they're advocating for several demands, including the imposing an arms embargo on Israel, like a two-way arms embargo. Then end national involvement in illegal Israeli settlements, addressing anti-Palestinian racism and protect freedom of expression about Palestine, and lastly recognize the state of Palestine, like that Canadian candidates recognize the state of Palestine. So it's mainly to protect and fund Gaza relief efforts. They provide also a list of the political party members across all the provinces that support the Vote for Palestine, which we can find on their website, Vote for Palestine.
Yeah. So there were, thanks for going over that and going over their demands. This is according to the Toronto Sun. So I honestly didn't really have enough time to fact check this, but according to the Toronto Sun, 25 of the 362 candidates who signed the Vote Palestine platform were elected. That's something. In Vote Palestine in Montreal, so this is kind of more like the positive side of things, there were two candidates who explicitly endorsed the Vote Palestine petition. And there may be other MPs who are, you know, more progressive on Palestine who just didn't sign on or something. I'm not really sure. But in Montreal, these were Alexandre Boulris, who ran in the NDP. At Rosemont La Petite Patrie. So the one NDP seat, actually, in Montreal, endorsed the Vote Palestine platform. And we also have Samir Zuberi, who is a liberal incumbent in Pierrefonds Dalaud. I was kind of surprised to see a liberal, endorsing the Vote Palestine, but Zuberi did endorse. And of the 18 candidates who ran, well, not the 18, but like, I guess of the, or was it 18? No, anyways, I think like, yeah, only these two endorsed the platform. So anyways, the Vote Palestine movement does not end after elections. You can, you know, kind of just encourage the MPs who did not sign on to endorse it. And so if you're kind of interested, go check out Vote Palestine. There's a lot of different ways to be engaged in pushing for, you know, your MPs to support Palestine beyond the ballot box day. So yeah, just kind of wanted to give you a little recap. Oh, did you want to? Yeah, actually, coming back, live fact-checking moment on the show. Kaya, if you wanted to mention, we were just talking a throwback to our conversation about Anthony Housefather and Neil Oberman.
Yeah, especially it makes sense considering how McGill administration is using the legal system to, you know, interfere in student governance. But like, we checked a little bit, and Neil Oberman, the MP candidate, was the lawyer who was supporting McGill in blocking the injunction, or supporting McGill in the injunction to block the policy against genocide. So that's what Neil Oberman's been doing, interfering in student politics, actually.
Wow, all our segments coming together.
Yeah, they're all, everything's connected. Mm.
And just for the listeners, the reason that we're mentioning this is because we were talking about Anthony Housefather, who is a liberal incumbent in Mount Royal, who I guess like had a kind of close competition for his seat with Neil Oberman, who is a conservative MP, or not MP, but who was a conservative candidate who was running. And yeah, we just found out that Neil Oberman was actually engaged in a pro-Israel lobbying, especially on campus. So interesting. Thank you for the fact checking.
Yeah, shout out to Jack.
Shout out to Jack, the spoken word coordinator, who ran down here to tell us this. But this is important information. So, so we are going to take a quick ad break again, and then we'll be back. And you do not want to miss this segment, guys. It's going to be like our, you know, off the hour takes on what this election can mean for progressives in Canada and just kind of our thoughts post-mortem. So stay tuned for that. We will be right back in just a second.
Montreal Reggae Massive, Friday, May 2nd. The Human Rights invite you to join us at Petit Café Campus as we celebrate the release of our new album, One People. Special guests, Akashic Nomad and Selectress Natty Rubin spinning all vinyl. Tickets are $20 advance, $25 at the door. Show starts at 8 p.m. Check out thehumanrights.ca for more information. Presented in association with CKUT 90.3 FM.
Saturday, May 3rd, CKUT joins forces with Queercore and Venus for a night of blistering live music at Tuscadora. Catch Puberty Well, Shunk, Steeple, Object of Loathing, and One Day Bender from 8 p.m. till 3 a.m. Tickets are $20, but no one's turned away at the door for lack of funds. Support the funding drive. Support Queer Radio. CKUT.ca/donate. Live, loud, and lesbian on the airwaves. Join Dykes on Mics on Monday, May 5th, broadcasting live from NDQ from 6 to 10 p.m. It's a celebration of queer voices, radical community, and 35 years of feminist radio at CKUT. Come through, show love, and help us bloom. More at ckut.ca/donate.
All right, welcome back to Off the Hour. So now we're going to do a bit of like a general election recap, talking about, I don't know, it's been a couple of busy days in the news cycle lately, so we're going to do a general recap of the federal election, our thoughts, particularly on the basically the collapse of the NDP and the progressive wing, in at least in Parliament, in the federal Parliament, and also the Conservatives kind of blowing their 25-point lead and like what that means for the future of their party, and just, you know, general thoughts about Mark Carney and the candidates and our liberal minority government that we seem to be having now. So I'm going to start by talking about how, so the Liberals now have a minority government. This basically came at the expense of the NDP and to a lesser extent the Bloc, but especially the NDP has cratered in the representation in Parliament. They now have only 7 seats, which means that they are under the threshold for the 12 seats that they would have needed to be an official party. Which a lot of it's been a lot of headlines lately, but I want to go over like what particularly that means in terms of their representation in Parliament. So basically, official party status means that they get extra funding. So this could be like for research groups, for office expenses, etc. So now that they're not an official party, they don't have any of that. They're being treated as like a coalition of independent candidates. So they're also not going to be able to sit near the front of the House of Commons. Which might mean like, you know, they'll have less attention. They're going to be able to ask less questions during question period, and they're not able to sit on parliamentary committees anymore. So this is like a very, very big deal in terms of the NDP's ability to even rebuild their platform now, because they're going to be just by necessity, they're going to be less in the news, right? Because they'll have less opportunities to get their questions out there. They'll have less opportunities. I mean, they're most likely going to form some kind of coalition with the Liberals, but they're going to have less opportunities to really question them and be active in Parliament, certainly not to the same extent as they were. Yeah. So I don't know if you guys want to jump in on this, like what do we think? Like, I mean, Singh has also stepped down as party leader. So clearly the NDP has to regroup in some direction, but I don't know if anybody knows exactly what they're going to do now and how they're going to regain their popularity, if they will.
Go ahead. I saw some commentators saying that this was sort of like almost an Americanization of the Canadian election, where people were rallying behind two parties and the other parties were sort of falling behind. And we definitely saw that. I mean, I feel like the conservatives, one thing to remember is the conservatives lost, but they had their largest popular vote share.
Yeah,
they gained a lot of seats. Mulroney since 85, and they gained lots of seats. And really, the vote share they won, it was something like 41%. That's like that's their ceiling. They can't win more than that.
Right.
There are something like 40% of people in Canada who will vote conservative or can be convinced, and other people just will not vote conservative, you know? And the real story here, like you're saying, is the collapse of the NDP, collapse of support for the Bloc in Quebec, and there's lots of different reasons for that, and we can get into that. But yeah, it's definitely a loss for the smaller parties. And I think a lot of people made the calculation that this is a really important election. We need to vote Liberal and make sure that Poilievre doesn't get in, and, you know, with Trump and all those things. And there's lots of other things that I'll talk about later going into that, but yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting you mentioning, like, rallying behind two parties, because it's not only people voting strategically, but a lot of parties were also, like, running strategically. Like, that's what happened with the Greens, and that's why they had to be, like, they were forced out of the federal leaders debate, was because Jonathan Pedneau was publicly saying, oh, we're running parliament members, we're running candidates strategically, we're pulling them out in ridings where conservatives are more likely to win. He said that with Radio Canada, and then that made the Green Party fall below the threshold of what was required to participate in the federal leaders debate. Like, that's the reason why they were kicked out, basically.
Wow.
Yeah, and I mean, it basically shows, I don't know, this is kind of just my own speculation, but I feel like if I mean, not the Greens, but if the NDP do want to regain their popularity in Parliament, I feel like they're going to have to pull from the Conservatives and not necessarily the Liberals. They might have to swipe some Liberal seats. I mean, some former NDP seats were swiped by the Liberals, but a lot of them were pulled into the Conservative bloc.
Well, I think a lot of that was the shift in BC.
Right.
Because in BC, the NDP fell off the map. It became a two-way race between the Conservatives and the Liberals for those seats. And in BC, they historically vote, like, Conservative or NDP. It's kind of a weird thing.
Well, so I also noticed, a lot of the seats, I don't have any the particular information on me, but a lot of the seats in BC, especially near the Vancouver area, they were actually, like, perfectly split between it actually happened that, like, people kind of voting strategically for the Liberals actually split the vote and gave a lot of victories to the Conservatives, because you had situations where you'd have, like, I don't know, 25% Liberal, 25% NDP, and the Conservatives polling at, like, 30-something, and then
and
they would win the seat.
The collapse of the NDP.
Right, yeah. Like, right.
That's like, an exact example.
A lot of
that.
These seats were former NDP, like, they were NDP incumbents. And so I think a lot of people, like, were... I do think a lot of former NDP voters were voting for the Liberals, like, out of a genuine desire to keep Poilievre out of office, which I don't think is a bad instinct necessarily. Or, sorry, I'm editorializing. I'm editorializing too much. Which I think if your goal is to keep Poilievre out of office, and you don't want a conservative victory, I think voting strategically, like, it's worked in the past. It's not a bad strategy. But it's a potential failure of that. It's just like a failure in calculation, right? Like, if you're if you just assume that the Liberals are the safer candidate in most ridings, you know, it directly contributed to a lot of the losses of NDP seats.
For sure. And this was kind of part of the story that I want to talk about a bit with this election, where looking at the election map sort of yesterday after I woke up, I was just looking at all the seats. And what I was noticing is that a lot of the rural ridings, a lot of the flips from Liberal to Conservative were in the rural ridings. So there were quite a few in Ontario. You have Bay of Quinte, you have Peterborough, which is... You know, there's a city, but it's pretty small. Kelowna, so kind of smaller cities, more like far away from the big urban centers. Carleton and Winnipeg West are sort of semi-suburban, semi-rural. And then Cumberland, Colchester, and South Shore, St. Margaret's in Nova Scotia.
Sorry.
Quite a few. These are all flips from Conservative to Liberal
to Liberal
in this election. And I think the story there is a lot of older people and people in more rural areas, people who feel more strongly about their Canadian identity, seeing this attack from Trump and saying, okay, we can't vote for Poilievre, we have to vote for Carney. People were really proud of being Canadian, and the Liberals were able to very effectively use that to in their advantage in this election. And then on the other hand, a lot of the flips from Liberal to Conservative, or towards the Conservatives in generally, were in the big cities, so mainly Vancouver and Toronto. So you have 9 seats that the Conservatives flipped from the Liberals in the 905 in the Greater Toronto Area. Among those, you have Richmond Hill South, Vaughan Broadbridge, Brampton West. And then there's, to a lesser extent, this happened in Quebec as well, in some suburban and rural ridings, the other way around, from Bloc Québécois to Liberal. So I feel like there was this big, like rural places, like rural Ontario, which often vote pretty heavily conservative, decided to go more liberal in this election, and urban areas, which I think the reason for this is that they bore the brunt of a lot of the liberal policies that have been very unpopular in the past few years, right? So very high levels of immigration, high pressure on housing, affordability, inflation, all things that are unpopular that Poiliev was able to successfully, even if he is, you know, and this isn't even editorializing, this is just looking at his plan. He didn't actually really have a plan to address these issues. But that was something that spoke to people. So that was,
I mean, I do think if your primary concern is housing and you're living like kind of in the 905, like, you know, GTA area, it's, you know, it's a pretty prescient, you know, it's pretty relevant to your daily life. So it's kind of understandable. But there are some interesting demographic outcomes when it comes to voting. I know before the show, we were talking about the fact that a lot of youth votes were swinging more towards conservative. And also, I did also want to talk about, like, the gender divide, too. Like, it was a lot of, like, young men specifically who more heavily supported Poiliev. I don't have these specific statistics on me. Whereas women tended to be more liberal, and older people also tend to swing more liberal.
Well, I saw that we run a student vote in every high school in Canada, and the student vote... in the student vote, 165 seats went to the Conservatives.
I did also see that too.
A lot more
Than
in real life, than in the actual election.
So that was, I think that was, anybody here can fact check me on this. That was like high schools, and it was also like elementary and middle schools, correct?
Yeah.
So it's interesting, like the fact that the youth vote is kind of swinging more towards like the Poiliev style kind of populist conservatism. I know a lot of people are kind of like connecting this to like kind of, the Manosphere podcast and like Andrew Tate and that kind of thing, which I think is also like it's definitely part of the puzzle. I think part of it is also like affordability and like the fact that, you know, the youth are going to bear the brunt of like the housing crisis and just the prospect of like, you know, not being able to find a job, not being able to like own a home. It's like, I mean, older people really don't have to worry about that, but the youth, you know, I can see like people seeing Poiliev as kind of like any kind of change being, you know, preferable to the kind of the current status quo. But yeah, like I do think that the gender divide and kind of like Pierre Poiliev's sort of, you know, I don't want to say masculinity, his appeals to this kind of more like bro-y, you know, right-wing populist energy, I can see how that appeals to like young dudes who kind of feel...
It's kind of like a dweeby masculinity.
I mean, you know, he got rid of his glasses and like he was trying to do like the, you know, I don't know. He's not really... I don't even think that... Look, my personal... This is kind of more of a pundit thing. My personal opinion about Poiliev is that I don't think that he would have been able to get like a real cult of personality behind him like Trump was able to do in the States, just because like he is kind of a dweeb. And like I don't think he has enough like personal charisma to really sustain that for a while.
And he's like a career politician. Yeah. So he's doesn't have the outsider sort of appeal.
He's not a genuine outsider. And I don't think he does a great job at pretending to be one.
For real.
But yeah. So like I don't necessarily... I think that the reason why the Conservatives were polling so heavily above the Liberals was because everybody hated Trudeau and people were sick of the Liberals, which is fair.
And like, Poiliev wanted to run against Trudeau. And then once Trudeau was gone, he just like floundered.
And I think
he was the perfect guy to go against Trudeau.
He was a very effective opposition
leader. He would get up in the House of Commons question period. He'd say, "Trudeau, you're bad, whatever." Yeah. People were like, "Oh, let's go. He's getting him." And then... You know, and then Trudeau left, and he just had no idea what to do with Carney and totally fumbled the bag with the Trump stuff as well. Like, he could have come out hard and said, we will never be the 51st state. We love Canada. We're proud of Canada. And somehow, he just totally didn't.
Yeah.
He did. Like, that worked really well for Doug Ford.
Like, yes.
That's a perfect example of, like, somebody who, a conservative in Canada, who leveraged the anti-Trump sentiment in Canada.
And called an election.
Absolutely became, like... Yeah, like that. Like he secured his third term with a significant majority, like because of like using that rhetoric and pivoting his campaign and everything. So
on that note, there is a bit of a rift happening within the Conservative Party now, especially because Poiliev lost his seat in Carleton. He's talking about staying on as the leader of the federal Conservatives. I don't know actually how that's I think they kind of have to figure out how that's going to happen, mm-hmm. just technically. But he clearly still wants to be kind of relevant and be the leader. But there has been a little bit of drama between people who are kind of more in the Doug Ford camp and people who more side with Poiliev. Doug Ford did not endorse anyone for PM explicitly, but he's relatively friendly with the Liberals. You know, he had breakfast with Mark Carney in Toronto. Yeah, yeah. We'll get to that. He's praised Chrystia Freeland in the past. You know, he's marketed himself as like a progressive conservative, emphasis on the progressive bit. You know, whether or not, you know, people believe that.
Oxymoron.
Well, you know, that's up to interpretation, but that's how he's presented himself. And it's drawn a lot of ire from conservatives who are more in the Poiliev camp. I'm just going to quote from, this is a conservative MP in the Toronto area, Jamil Giovanni, who's also happens to be close friends of J.D. Vance. They were Yale Law School buddies. So to the CBC, as the votes are being counted on election night, he said of Doug Ford, he couldn't stay out of our business, always getting his criticisms and all his opinions out, distracting our campaign, trying to make it all about him, trying to position himself as some kind of political genius that we need to be taking cues from. This so, like to the CBC.
Yeah, this was during his, victory speech.
Yeah.
I actually think it was. CBC comes in, talks to the candidate, be like, well, what do you think? And this is like, that's what he chose.
Yeah, and so he chose to sound off about Ford. And, I mean, it's going to be interesting because Ford has like substantial popularity in Ontario. People have been talking about him being the federal leader. Yeah. It's unclear like what his future is going to be what his relationship is going to be like with the federal Conservative Party. But clearly there is a rift forming between people who are I guess like more kind of centrist, like, you know, red Tories they call them. A little bit more siding with Doug Ford's style of politics, which, you know, he goes to the pride parades and he's kind of like friendly with the Liberals, versus, you know, Poiliev's style of like really being like an attack dog populist, kind of harder to the right. I don't know, like, what are you guys' thoughts on this?
Well, it's hilarious. Coming from Toronto, it's hilarious that Doug Ford is the moderate now and not the attack dog, because he was seen as the attack dog crazy guy in Toronto politics.
Well, he is, he has a rambunctious personality.
Yeah,
we'll say that.
But he's not, in comparison, you're right, he's not like Poiliev or anything like that. I think the biggest barrier for Doug Ford in federal politics, because we are in Quebec, is that he doesn't really speak French.
No,
I mean,
he had that
famous restez à la maison, whatever, during COVID, and I don't know. Again, this is just personal opinion. I don't know how capable he is of learning thoroughly right now French. I don't know. Whether or not
he's going to be like any kind of he's going to have any kind of federal presence is. I mean, I can't speculate. But there does seem to be a certain like a definite rift in the conservatives.
I think since he seized on a lot of the like nationalist rhetoric like after Trump's attacks, I think it would be interesting to see him in federal politics. I mean,
it shows that style of politics worked. It worked for him, going super hard against Trump, you know, waving like, you know, like really leaning into that kind of Canadian nationalism, not worrying about like woke politics. That strategy worked for him. It was able to unite a lot of people who were not necessarily super socially conservative, but who liked his kind of, you know, forceful style of politics and his strong stance against the U.S.
Yeah. And I think sort of the like anti-woke stuff really came back to bite Poiliev.
Well, because he sounds like Trump.
Yeah, he just it seems like he's just parroting all the same stuff and kind of like taking people out of the like concrete matters of their lives, like the housing crisis and all of these sort of things.
You just have like two more minutes left here. I did just want to mention one thing, just actually talking about the conservative, like it's interesting that like Mark Carney ran on a, I would say, like, very center-right platform.
Yeah, he's,
right?
Like, I'd call him a centrist. Yeah, yeah.
But, like, certainly center-right. Like, is, like, definitely trying to, like, yeah, he's just, like, center-right. Got rid of the carbon tax, got rid of the capital gains tax. That made a lot of rich people very happy.
He's
a lot
not.
Of business people very happy. And I guess just, like, in our final minute, like, what does that mean? Like, when we have a Liberal Party that's running very center-right, we have a very strong conservative opposition and no leftist, like, you know, opposition parties. That's an interesting time for Canadian politics. That's not a great time for us. So, yeah, I don't know. It's just fun to think about for progressive politics in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to have final word.
10 seconds, I think it's not necessarily a bad thing in the moment that we're in right now. I mean, they still have a minority government, so there's going to be sort of BQ or NDP voice there. Mm-hmm. And we need to negotiate with Trump. We need to face this moment right now, and the progressive parties in Canada will recover with new leadership. I think Singh was not really a good leader, and with new leadership, hopefully they'll recover.
Yeah. Amen to that. Thank you guys so much for tuning in to Off the Hour. We will see you guys next week.
Bye.
Your station. Plant the seeds of your support today. Call 514-907-9424 or visit ckut.ca/donate. CKUT 90.3 FM, blooming from the heart of Montreal.
Making contact.
Today on Making Contact, we bring you The Healing Project, a multimedia installation that features personal stories from those who are incarcerated and highlights the deep trauma that imprisonment has had on their lives and their loved ones. When you walk into The Healing Project at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts in San Francisco, you see a piano centered in the middle of a huge space, connected to three smaller rooms. There's sound coming from every direction. People's voices talking about their life experiences with prisons. There's an altar against one wall, draped with prayer beads, white candles, dried flowers, and bottles of alcohol. Above it is a mural of a person crowned with flowers, their faces in a silhouette, but somehow feels like you can look into their eyes.
Welcome to The Healing Project. This is basically just the title wall. Obviously, for like any type of exhibition, you have the title wall, which is like an introduction context.